Now, the last time we did a sutta class, I already read out the Anatta doctrine, but I'm just going to read it out again just as a nice introduction to the stuff which is coming afterwards. And also because I love the Anatta doctrine. And these are the wonderful similes of Anatta with which made by the Buddha, which gives it a nice way of understanding it. The Anatta doctrine. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya. Suppose that this river Ganges was carrying along a great lump of foam, and a person with good sight would inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow and empty. For what solidity could one find in a mere lump of foam? So too, whatever kind of form, body, there is, whether past, future or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, you inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to you to be void, empty, insubstantial. For what solidity could there be in form? That's the first component of existence. Supposed it were raining and big raindrops are falling, a water bubble arises and bursts on the surface of the water. A person with good sight would inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow and momentary. For what permanence could there be in a water bubble? So too, whatever kind of experience there is, and as you know, experience is the preferred translation which I give to Vedana. Instead of calling it feeling, I prefer saying experience. I think that's more accurate. Whatever kind of experience there is, whether past, future or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, you inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to you to be void, empty, momentary. For can anything constant be found in experience? A prop of a water bubble. Suppose that in the last month of the hot season, around noon, even though this was designed to be understood by those in India, still I think the last month of the warm weather, like here today, around noon, a shimmering mirage appears. A person with good sight would inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow, and illusory. For what reality could there be in a mirage? So too, whatever kind of perception there is, whether past, future, or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near. Is that better? Okay. Far or near, you inspect it and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow, and illusory. For what reality could there be in a mirage? So too, whatever kind of perception there is, whether past, future, or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, you inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to you to be void, empty, illusory. For what reality could there be in perception? Suppose a person needing hardwood would take a chainsaw and enter a forest. And just a quick point, I know people afterwards, they ask me, it doesn't say chainsaw in the suttas, it just says an ordinary saw. But no one in their right mind would enter a forest to chop down a tree with a handsaw. Take a chainsaw and enter a forest. There they would see the trunk of a large banana tree, straight, fresh, without a fruit bud core. They would cut it down at the root, cut off the crown, and unroll the coil. As they unroll the coil, they would not find even soft wood, let alone hard wood. A person with good sight would inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow and without a base. For what basis could there be in the trunk of a banana tree? So too, whatever kind of will there is, my preferred translation for Sankara, the fourth of the five khandhas. Whatever kind of will there is, whether past, future or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, you inspect it and carefully investigate it. As you investigate them, it appears to you to be void, empty and hollow. For what underlying basis could there be in volition? Suppose that a magician would perform a trick at a crossroads. A person with good eyesight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it. And it would appear to them to be void, hollow, and deceptive. For what truth could there be in a magical trick, a magical illusion? So too, whatever kind of consciousness there is, whether past, future, or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, whatever kind of consciousness. You inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to you to be void and empty and deceptive. For what authenticity could there be in consciousnesses? That was a standard description of the five components of existence, leaving no component out. Whatever kind of consciousness, whatever kind of will, sankhara, whatever kind of perception, sanya, whatever kind of vedana, experience, whatever kind of body, whatever kind, a whole lot. There's nothing which is permanent, substantial, some sort of basis in there at all. And now to also emphasize the consequences of this, from Samyutta 22, the 39th sutta. One who seeks pleasure in a body seeks only irritation. One who seeks irritation, I say, is not freed from suffering. One who seeks gratification in experiences seeks only disappointment. One who seeks disappointment, I say, is not freed from suffering. One who seeks reality in perception seeks only illusions. And one who seeks for illusions, I say, is not freed from suffering. One who seeks contentment in volition seeks only frustration. One who seeks frustration, I say, is not freed from suffering. And one who seeks eternity in consciousnesses seeks only for the affliction of more rebirth. One who seeks for rebirth, I say, is not freed from suffering. And this is just why we seek pleasure in the body, gratification and experience, some reality in our perceptions, and a contentment, you know, through the exercise of your will, trying to get somewhere and solve problems, or eternity in consciousness. Why do people want to be conscious? sometimes to get to the eternal, unborn, ungrounded consciousness will last forevermore. That's why I use the translation, eternity in consciousnesses. Seeks only for the affliction of more rebirth. You keep coming back again forever. Well, not forever, until you get wise. One who seeks for rebirth, I say, is not free from suffering. And then this little page from the Dhammapada. Why this laughter? Why this joy when it's ever burning? Shrouded all about in gloom, won't you look for the light? Look at this attention-demanding body. A mass of irritations, constantly needing support, prone to illness, with nothing stable or lasting. The body gets worn out, so fragile, an incubator for disease. When life ends in death, this disappointing body dissolves. And I kind of like that idea. Even when I was young, you look at your body, it is demanding. Even when you were fit, it was still demanding. You need a scratch here, you need a piece of food, it's too hot, it's too cold, it needs a drink of water, it needs something. And as you get older, of course, the irritations get more demanding, constantly needing support, get headaches and migraines and aches here and aches there. It's prone to illness, nothing stable or lasting. Some of you have to wear your masks to try and keep that away. It doesn't work, the mask. You're still going to get sick and you're still going to die. You just put it off for a little bit longer. And it gets worn out, fragile, an incubator for disease. And when life ends in death, this disappointing body dissolves. And now these are the three warnings. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya. I used to talk about this a lot when I was a lay person, because it was a standard part of Buddhism. We don't say so much these days about this. But my friend, didn't you ever see a man or woman 80 years of age or more? Quite a few people had their 80th birthday recently, or they're going to have it soon. And frail, sickly, struggling to walk, even with a walking frame, with many a complaint, strength gone, with false teeth and white hair or a wig, with wrinkled skin and blotched limbs and forgetful. Just, I don't mind saying this, but last night I had a good opportunity of visiting two of the wonderful supporters of our monastery. That's Ainsley and Barbara in South Perth. Now they've got blotched limbs. They're getting old. Sorry, they've got old. So they need to look after themselves. And when you look at them, you know, you can see that they're aging, that they're aged, and sometimes get forgetful. My friend, didn't it occur to you, each one of you, intelligent and mature person, I too, each one of you, am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. Let me now do good karma while I still can, by body, speech, and mind. But my friend, didn't you ever see a man or a woman sick, moaning, gravely ill, bedridden, incontinent? My friend, didn't occur to you, an intelligent and mature person, each one of you, I too am subject to illness, not exempt from illness. Let me now do good karma while I still can, by body, speech, and mind. But my friend, didn't you ever see among human beings a dead man or a woman in a coffin about to be cremated or buried? My friend, did it not occur to you, an intelligent and mature person, each one of you in this room, I too am subject to death. I am not exempt from death. Let me now do good karma while I still can, by body, speech, or mind. And this is finishing off the first noble truth of suffering with just a description of samsara. This samsara is without a beginning. A first point is not found of beings roaming and wandering on, blinded by delusion and addicted to wanting. Sometimes they say desire or craving. I prefer the translation wanting because that's more broad and more accurate. What do you think, which is more? The stream of tears that you have wept as you have roamed and wandered on through your many lives, weeping and wailing because of enduring the disagreeable and not getting what you want, this or the water in all the great oceans? For a long time you have experienced grief through the death of a loved one or of a dear friend, or the loss of reputation or wealth. As you have experienced this, weeping and wailing because of enduring despair and not getting what you want, the stream of tears that you have wept is more than the water in all the great oceans. Which do you think is more? The streams of blood that you have shed when you were beheaded, as you roamed and wandered on through this long course, this or the water in all the great oceans? For a long time you have been arrested as murderers, burglars, adulterers, and when you are beheaded, the stream of blood that you shed is greater than the water in all the great oceans. For what reason? Because this samsara is without a beginning. The first point is not discerned of beings who, blinded by delusion and addicted to wanting, are journeying through this round of rebirth and death. That's from the Samyutta Nikaya. Now straight away, the reason I wanted to just mention that was that some people still say, oh, the Buddha never talked about rebirth. You can be a Buddhist without really accepting that he taught rebirth. And that is quite total nonsense. The Buddha always predicated his teachings on the understanding of rebirth. This is not your only life, it never will be. So people who say, oh, the Buddha never taught rebirth, that's just been added on later on. I can't see how you can maintain such an idea. Even just one person wandering on through their many lives, just one person, blinded by delusion, addicted to wanting, would leave behind a stack of bones, a heap of bones, a mass of bones, as large as Mount Everest, if there was someone to collect them all, and what was collected would not perish. For what reason? Because this samsara is without a beginning. For such a long time, you have experienced suffering, agony, and disaster, and swelled the cemeteries with your bones from your many lives. It is enough to experience revulsion towards all volitional formations, enough to let go of the cause of more birth, enough to be liberated from samsara. I didn't quite have the chance to finish it off last time, but anyway, today it was finished off. That's negative, but it shows you just the situation we're in. It's nice to say that's not true, or there's another way of looking at it, but that's how the Buddha meant it to be heard. Now, of course, when you make the problem very clear, the next part is the cause of that problem, the origin of suffering. So is that okay to carry on now without any questions until a bit later? Good. The second noble truth, the origin of suffering. Now this is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is this wanting. The word in Pali is tanha. It also means thirst. When you're really thirsty, you have to take a drink. It's something, even if you don't take the drink, you can still feel that tension in you, that wanting. It is this wanting which leads to rebirth, accompanied by enjoyment and desire, seeking delight, now here, now there. That is the wanting related to the five senses. Wanting to be and wanting not to be. Now the first of those wantings, they call karma tanha. Karma tanha is K long A M A, singular. And I remember just having a lovely discussion with Ajahn Bhumali, who just did a little exercise to check every time you have K long A M A, what it means is related to the five senses. Is that all the senses there are? No. We have the sixth sense of the mind. But it's the wanting related to those five senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, which leads to rebirth. The joys of the sixth sense, that leads to some of the heaven realms, especially the realms of Sudarvasa. But from the Sudarvasa, automatically, eventually after a time, you let go of any desires for the sixth sense. But this particular sense here, the five senses, is the craving belonging to that realm, or anything to do with the five senses, that is what is meant by the karma tanha. However, there's also some of the other cravings like bhava tanha. It's the wanting to be of existence. Whether pleasurable or not pleasure, we want to exist. And the Buddha said that's the second cause of the origin of suffering. And the last cause is the wanting not to be, annihilation. And the Buddha said that is like the dog chasing its own tail, trying to bite its tail off. It just can't reach it. It's a wanting to annihilate, get rid of something. It's still a wanting. And that's what the wanting is. The origin of wanting. And where does this wanting arise and become established? Wherever in the world there is anything agreeable and pleasurable, there this wanting arises and becomes established. Sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tangibles, and mind objects in the world are agreeable and pleasurable. Then there is this wanting arises and becomes established. The six consciousnesses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and mind, are agreeable and pleasurable, and there this wanting arises and becomes established. Experience of the six senses is agreeable and pleasurable, and there this wanting arises and becomes established. The perception of sight, sound, smells, taste, touches, and mind objects is agreeable and pleasurable, and there this wanting arises and becomes established. Will in regard to sight, sound, smell, taste, touches, and mind objects is agreeable and pleasurable. And there this wanting arises and becomes established. I don't know if you're getting it here, but it's not just the pleasure in these things, it's just having experience. Yes, we preferred if we could choose to have pleasant experience, but experience in itself is something which we desire, even unpleasant stuff. And perceptions are agreeable and pleasurable, and sometimes we just want different perceptions, stranger perceptions, just to see if we can have experienced that yet. I still can't understand why doing bungee jumping or something is a pleasant experience. But apparently people get off on that. They just want to experience things. And will, even will in itself is pleasurable, just to do something. Whether you reach your goal or not, we just love to will. There's a pleasure in that. Wanting itself is pleasurable. It's like we're alive, we're doing something, we're wanting something. Those sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, and mind objects, it's agreeable and pleasurable. And there this wanting arises and becomes established. Thinking of sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, and mind objects is agreeable and pleasurable. And there this wanting arises and becomes established. It's amazing that people actually can perceive thinking to be pleasurable. Unless you have to think too much, and then you know it for what it really is. The thinking is nearly always, it's untrustworthy. It betrays you. It promises many things, but it never actually gives you what it promises, thinking. Fantasizing about sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, and mind objects is agreeable and pleasurable. And there this wanting arises and becomes established. And that is called the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It's not just an experience of the senses. It's just, and you may have noticed here, we said with all these things here, the six senses, but karma dhanha refers to the five senses. So where does the sixth sense relate? And that's to bhava dhanha and vibhava dhanha, the desire to be, to exist. Because to be, to exist, we think that means to perceive, to think, to will, to want. All those things are part of what one understands as being. And wanting that being, that is called suffering, the cause of suffering. Dependent origination of all phenomena, on seeing a sight, and the same with the other six senses, you want it if it is pleasing. You try to get rid of it if it is unpleasing. You abide with mindfulness and wisdom of the five senses unestablished. With a limited mind, and you do not understand as it actually is, the liberation of mind and liberation by wisdom wherein those deceiving and oppressive states cease without remainder. Engaged as you are in favoring and opposing, whatever experience, Vedana, you have, whether pleasant or painful or neutral, you delight in that experience. Welcome it and remain holding on to it. As you do so, delight arises in you. Now delight in experience is a fuel. With the fuel, we call it upadana. And upadana literally means adana, as in adina adana, where amini, taking what is not given. Upa literally means up, means taking up. Taking up that Vedana as a fuel. States of existence develop, with states of existence as condition, rebirth, with rebirth as a condition, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, negativity, and distress come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. What it's saying here is that wanting is putting it in the context of dependent origination. The next little part here, somebody asked me about this, and so I added it in here. A lot of times that people start talking about, you know, the Dhamma, is it just in the present moment, here and now? And we have a phrase we use in the description of the Dhamma, sanditiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko. Sanditika, what does that word mean? It does not mean here and now. Here is the description of sanditika. With the five senses as the cause, the source and the basis, the culprit being simply the five senses, presidents quarrel with prime ministers, politicians with each other, priests with imams, businessmen with householders, monks with nuns, parents quarrel with each other and with their children, sibling with sibling and friend with friend, and here in the quarrels, brawls and disputes, they attack each other with abuse, weapons or lawsuits, whereby they incur death, injury or loss. Now this too is a danger in the case of the five senses, a mass of suffering in this very life, the cause being simply the five senses. Again, with the five senses as the cause, people steal, commit fraud, sleep with other people's partners, commit domestic violence, sexually abuse their children, and when they are caught, they are imprisoned and ruined. Now this too is a danger in the case of the five senses, a mass of suffering in this very life, the cause being simply the five senses. So we don't say this is the here and now. It means you can see it in this very life. You know, when you do something wrong, you know, many people you can see going to jail, losing all their wealth, losing their reputations because of all this stuff which they perform, which is bad karma. It doesn't mean in this very moment. It means in this very life, as opposed to something in the future life. Future karma result, samparayika. Again, with the five senses as the cause, the source and the basis, the culprit being simply the five senses, people indulge in misconduct of body, speech and mind. Having done so, after death, they reappear in states of misery in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in the hell realm. Now this is a danger in the case of the five senses, a mass of suffering in the life to come, having the five senses as its cause, as its source and its basis, the cause being simply the five senses. And those two passages are quoted together because it just shows that one is the antonym, the opposite of the other. Samparayika is what you can find out in the next life. Sanditika, what you can experience in this very life. I make it clear? Okay. We're coming close to the end of this second noble truth, and then we can have some questions. You will not find a spot in the world, not in the sky, not in the ocean, not inside a mountain cave, where you will be free from the results of karma. Is that scary? It doesn't mean just bad karma. Why do always people assume to escape from the karma? Do you want to escape from the good karma you've done? Because karma doesn't just mean bad karma. It just means there's all types of karma. Anyway, karma as volition. Volition is karma, I say. For having willed, you act by body, speech or mind. And what is the diversity of karma? Is karma to be experienced in hell realms, or in the animal realms, or in the ghost realms, or in the human realm? And is karma to be experienced in the deva realms? And what is the result of karma? The result of karma, I say, is threefold. To be experienced in this very life, or in the next life, or in some subsequent life. So sometimes you can experience karma in many lives, you know, from the time you actually made that karma. Inheritance of deeds. Beings are the owners of their karma. the heirs of their karma. They have karma as their origin, karma as their property, karma as their resort. Whatever karma they do, good or bad, they are its heirs. So your inheritance is what you inherit in this life and what you inherit in future lives. You made that. Wherever that karma ripens, it is there that you experience its result, either in this very life, on the next life, or in some subsequent life. There comes a time when the great oceans dry up and evaporate and no longer exist. But still, I say, there is no making an end of suffering for those beings roaming through rebirth and death, blinded by delusion and addicted to wanting. There comes a time when the Himalaya, the king of the mountains, burns up and perishes and no longer exists. But still, I say, there is no making an end of suffering for those beings roaming through rebirth and death, blinded by delusion and addicted to wanting. There comes a time when the planet Earth burns up, turns into cosmic dust, spreading throughout the universe, and no longer exists. But still, I say, there is no making an end of suffering for those beings roaming through rebirth and death, blinded by delusion and addicted to wanting. So, that is the passages relating to the second noble truth, the cause of suffering. Now don't get too disappointed yet, because the next noble truth is the cessation of suffering. But, any questions so far? From the UK, so should you give up enjoying sense pleasures? How do you do so when it is so pleasurable? You see the danger in them. Because sometimes you can see how they're advertised in the campaign, which you can see on your internet or TV. If you haven't bought this latest car, then you haven't experienced, you know, real life yet. Have you, I keep on saying, seen the Great Wall of China? You haven't lived to do that. Have you got to enjoy all these sense pleasures? And quite frankly, as a monk, you know, when you gave up so many sense pleasures, you thought you were missing out on some things. And eventually these things, they came to you. And a good example of that, I remember being in Thailand as a monk and started thinking about fish and chips. I said, I'm really just, you know, missing out on my favorite food. And then, so when I came over here to Australia, then I managed to get some hot fish and chips. Now, I'd gone to a funeral service, there's no way of making it back into monastery in time. And so I managed to get permission from Ajahn Chakra at the time to go and get some fish and chips on the way back to Bodhinyana Monastery. We got some fish and chips, it was all organized, I got a nice place to buy it from, it's still, you know, before midday, and got up to eat it. It was so disappointing. I've been thinking about this for years. And when you actually get it, it's not what the fantasy told me it would be like. And that's the thing about enjoying sense pleasures, thinking about it, planning for it, getting that food on the table right in front of you, that's kind of promising. But when you actually take that sense pleasure, it just vanishes almost immediately. It's nothing like you expected. And I quoted that last sutta class, pleasures are like poppies spread. You pluck the flower, the bloom is shed. Or like the snowfall in the river, white for a moment, then gone forever. That's a Scots poet, Robert Burns. It's ephemeral. Give up enjoying sense pleasures. Why do you say that in plural? Pleasures. Because as soon as you've got one, you've got to get another. It's endless. I don't know, what would you like to eat now? If I could, if I could wave my magic wand and get you your favorite food? And if you had fish and chips, it wouldn't be enough, good enough. You know, you want some salt, or you want some lemon or something. And you got some lemon, it's too sour or something. How demanding are sensory pleasures? Honestly, do they ever satisfy?
I find this thing is a bit contradictory, you know, okay? Wanting, like desire, you know, all these things, okay? Like if you do it excess, you know, bring suffering, yes, you know, okay, yeah. That's also debatable too, okay, yeah. And how does desire bring bad karma?
I'm going to interrupt you because you can see that if it's bad karma, very bad karma, certainly it brings bad results. But even ordinary wanting becomes an addiction. It never allows you to be peaceful. And when people indulge in those sensory pleasures, they find it very difficult to meditate. There's a simile I haven't said in this particular book, but which is pertinent, the simile of the wet piece of wood. If somebody wants to make a fire, usually with two fire sticks, they get this piece of wood out of the lake or out of the river, and they try and rub it with a dry stick to try and make some fire. They can't do that. It's too wet. Or they pick a stick which is away from the river, but not too far away. It's still damp. They rub that, they can't find a fire. But if they find a stick a long way from the river and rub that with their fire stick, they can successfully make a flame. And you use that simile. You have to be far away from indulging in sensory pleasures to successfully make a fire. This is actually to get that deep meditations, which are necessary to see things as they truly are. Mm. Without those deep meditations, one will always feel that there's some sensory pleasure somewhere, something which is worth wanting. But after a while, you find it just gives you frustration.
Can I just say, sorry, it's interesting, Ajahn, Ajahn Brahm, you know, I read in many sources too, you know, it says, the Buddha says, you know, okay, getting the desire, okay, brings suffering, okay? Not getting it is also suffering, you know?
Correct.
So what do we do as human beings, you know? And how does
you stop wanting anything.
Sorry?
You stop wanting things.
Yeah, but it is said the path also, that's a clock, yeah, the path towards enlightenment is the middle way.
That middle
and then
way.
Now you have this one is to the extreme, you know. So how do we go?
This is exactly that middle path.
Huh?
That middle path is letting go of karma, sukali, kanu yoga, the five sense pleasures, avoiding those, and avoiding asceticism, atagalamatanu yoga. That's the middle path. So it's letting go of the five sense pleasures. Okay.
Can I just follow on from what Eddie said?
Yeah.
Even when you go on the middle path as such, there's still a form of wanting there.
That form of wanting decreases. And this is, you've heard me say this many times, in meditation, you don't do meditation. You don't want it. You sit there and restrain all the wanting. An amazing thing happens. All the stuff which you aspired for and think that wanting is the way to get there, you realize it doesn't get there. All those similes, this is not the word of the Buddha, the word of Ajahn Chah, sitting under a mango tree, perfectly still, just put a hand out and a mango will fall. I couldn't understand that when I was a young monk. That was rubbish. But later on, as meditation grew, wisdom grew, what a beautiful teaching that was. When you sit in meditation, you don't want anything in the whole world. really content. Then you start to feel a peace and contentment, which is blissful. And the mind goes into these deep states, away from the world of the five senses, into the world of the mind. You bliss out. You get sort of these pleasures which are far greater than anything the world can offer you. And this simply happens because you have a bit of trust. When the Buddha said, no wanting, let's give it a go. It's radical teachings. I agree with you there. Thank you for answering the questions. That's why it's amazing teachings.
So all the wanting, when you are sitting there and you're going through the middle path, the body at some point does need to have water. It does need to have some substance at some kind, surely.
No. That's the amazing thing when you see these gurus and stuff. There was that little kid who was sitting, not moving or not taking any drink, over in India somewhere for days. Even to some of the monks which I've known, sit so still with it. That Vietnamese monk over in Sydney sat for 8 days, supposed to be teaching a meditation retreat, never drank, never ate anything. It was almost, let's say, like suspended animation. And then came out afterwards, after 8 days. There's some stuff which is weird, and I'm not just making this up. This is real stuff. So sometimes we think, oh, we've got to get something. The answer, do you?
I'm sorry. You
need to get some things, but do you? How much of the objects of our wanting, what generates that wanting, is really necessary? A lot of it you can put aside. Live really simply.
So you're saying then, once you hit that middle path then, you can go on for the rest of your time here on earth that way?
Yeah, why not?
Okay.
Until you die and pass away. Okay, there's a question over here.
Ajahn, can there be agreeable things and pleasing things, but you are not taking it as you, so you don't have wanting?
No, even agreeable things. The most agreeable thing, you know, what I asked you to get me for my next birthday, is nothing. In other words, the most agreeable things is just leaving things alone.
Sorry?
The most agreeable thing is like not wanting anything at all. And again, all those things which you feel are necessary for life, especially like as a monk or as a nun, they come to you. You sit under the Bodhi tree, hold a hand out, and the fish and chips comes in your bowl. It's true, you know. Yeah, go on.
So Ajahn, what's left, is it just the second path factor? That you live by?
Sorry?
Yeah, I mean those kind of motivations, that, you know, if you're not pursuing sense pleasures or oppressive austerities, do you just follow, you function basically from the second path factor?
Second path factor.
Is that the right motivations?
Oh, right, the second of the Eightfold Path. Okay, yes. Yeah, basically, yeah. Just nothing happens.
Yeah. And I guess for those to really be empowered, you have to have some quite developed right view.
Exactly, yeah.
Thank you.
So I'm going to now go on to the third Noble Truth. This is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same wanting. Wanting related to the five senses, wanting for existence and wanting not to be. Remainderless fading away and cessation of that same wanting, the giving up and relinquishing of it, freedom from it, never letting it settle enough to grow. And those of you who have perceptive enough realize that this is the four ways of letting go: Chaga, Patinisaga, Muti, Analaya. Chaga is often used for generosity. Like those of you, someone actually, two people this morning did give me fish and chips on the table. That's not what chaga means. That's only a small part of chaga. Chaga means also just giving things up, giving up the wanting. This is almost like a first part of wanting, the generosity, when you're letting go of what, you know, you control, what you own. You let that go. You give it away. You have the grief of the past, the bad feelings of the past. Why can't we just give it up? This is what I've seen with like people in prisons. They've done a crime, but after a while, when they believe that they're that crime, they overly focus on it. It does become something which they repeat afterwards. It's like, you know, they're a thief. They're a thief. They're a murderer. They're a rapist. I've seen many men who have raped, but they're not rapists. They're a person who's raped. Terrible thing to do, but they're more than that. They keep focusing on the pain. The pain remains, and they repeat it. You think, why would a person who's been in jail ever want to do it again? It hurts. You don't get freedom by overly thinking and keeping those bad memories of the past. You really do let them go. It's like it was another person. Not me, not mine. It was in the past. And of course, a big example of that is someone like Angulimala, a serial killer. And the Buddha found him before the police did, and he ordained him. And his advice to Angulimala, the wonderful saying, stop! Stop, Angulimala. And Angulimala stopped. Stop letting the mind go to the past. Stop any more ill will. And he became fully enlightened. Fully enlightened, which is incredible. That could happen. You can let go so much immediately. Anyway, that's chaga. Relinquishing it, patinisaga, that literally means like throwing it out, throwing it away. Renouncing it. Cutting off that connection between you, your sense of self, and the past. It's amazing that some of these deeper teachings, like of non-self, when you penetrate that and really get into it very deeply, now you realize the problem with the grief, the guilt, revenge, fear of the past, is you, your sense of self, becomes defined by the past. That's who you are. You make yourself that. And when you can actually separate that, cut that link, is that who you really are? Are you really like you were a former lawyer before. You were, what were you before? Each one of you, some of you have retired. You lived in Bangladesh before Mukta. You know, you, what did you do before when you were working? Sorry? Money? Okay. But is that really who you are? That was in the past. I was a theoretical physicist. Click. You cut that off. That's not who you are. All the good stuff and bad stuff, whatever you do, you can just not connect with that. It means it's sometimes hard to understand, you know, who you are, because we usually define ourselves by what we did in the past. Are you an old lady? That's in the future, or maybe the present, I'm not sure. But anyway, we cut that so that we don't associate with anything. When you see non-self, really see it, that's when you can cut off the past and the future. You've thrown that out. People say, how can you do that? When you see non-self, you don't own anything. Not me, not mine, not a self. Everything you've done in the past. You may not feel you can do it right now, but you can see the possibility and how it's achieved. It's also the reason why, I've said this before, it's off the subject here, but it's relevant to you because of what's been asked, that when you become a stream winner, soul one, you've actually not just entered the path, you achieved that stream winning, then you've seen non-self, which means anything, the bad stuff you've done in the past, you cut it off. You don't need to be reborn in a lower realm ever again, no matter what you've done. It can be done, it is done, that's how it's done. That's Patinissaka. The next one, the freedom from it, freedom from wanting. How can you do that? And that is, are you happy to be here in this hall today? It's a bit of noise, it may be a bit hot, you may find it hard to hear. Are you happy to be here? If you are happy to be here, you feel free. You don't want anything. If you're getting bored and fed up and thinking, when is this going to end? You want something. And then this hall becomes like being in prison. You're not free at all. It doesn't matter if you've got iron bars surrounding you and huge walls and guards patrolling on those walls. If you're not happy to be here, it's a prison. If you're happy to be here, you're free. Freedom is that sense of mind when you're at peace with things. You don't want anything in the whole world. No wanting, you feel free. I'll just do the last one, then we'll just devote the rest of the time to questions. And never letting it settle enough to grow. That was a hard translation for the word analia. And alia is well known in, should be well known, Himalaya. Himalaya. Hima means snow. Alaya means where the snow settles, the Himalaya mountains. Meghalaya. Meghalaya, another state in India, that's where the clouds always are. That's Meghalaya. Alaya means where things settle and grow, like the snow or like clouds. So Analaya means never allowing any place where things grow. It's like, sometimes I call it the Teflon mind. So, and that's also the simile of the onion, which I've often mentioned. When someone urinates on an onion, when someone urinates on a lotus, the urine just falls right off the lotus, nothing sticks to it, and afterwards the lotus doesn't smell. And you pour some perfume over the lotus, you soak that lotus in perfume, but nothing sticks to the lotus, not even a smidgen sticks to the lotus. Everything that perfume just disappears. It still smells like a lotus. Nothing sticks to a lotus. which is why it's analya. That whatever comes up into your life, praise or blame, any of the worldly dhammas, happiness and suffering, gain and loss. What's the last of those four pairs? Sorry? Oh yeah, fame and risk, yeah. That is a crazy thing. And even these days, okay, that sometimes I'm well known now, so I have some crazy experiences. Just last night when they were taking me to Ainsley and Barbara's, I mentioned to them about going on a flight to give on a conference over in Yogyakarta in Indonesia. So we flew to Bali first of all on Garuda Airlines. And I was just sitting in economy class minding my own business when one of the flight attendants came past just to check all the passengers and stopped and took one look at me and said, "Are you Ajahn Brahm?" I said, "Yeah, last time I checked." I actually said that last time I checked. And then she put her hand over her heart. "Oh, I must be one of your major disciples in Indonesia. I've read all of your books. They're amazing. Oh, it's such a pleasure. You're on my flight." It was really over the top. Burr was there. She saw it. And then anyway, one of the problems was that once they served a simple breakfast and took everything away, then she came to me again and said, "Please, Ajahn Brahm, can you please come up to the front of the galley?" I didn't know what she was going to do with me. I said, "Okay." So we went up to the front of the galley, and then all the flight attendants were there for a photo shoot. Indonesians, that's what they're like. And they took one photo after another. And at the time, all the buttons from the clients, you know, the passengers were going beep, 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 beep. They wanted another beer. So one of the flight attendants said, "Just hold on for 5 minutes. We're busy at the moment." Photograph and photograph and photograph. It was crazy. So that is sometimes what that is like. You get harassed on the flight. I just want a nice quiet time to meditate. They wouldn't let me. So fame and lack of fame, they'll always come together. Anyway, that is by, what's going on? That's not letting anything settle enough to grow. Okay, now it's so we can have questions. So Ananda has the first question, come on.
Thank you, Ajahn. And when you were explaining that freedom from it, which is mutti, you mentioned that happy to be here, so really wanting to be here.
No, if it's wanting, you're never happy.
Okay, happy.
Wanting is future.
Yes, okay, happy to be here. Isn't that a small scale of bhavatanha, to be here?
No, remember wanting means this is where you are, you want to be somewhere else. If you're happy to be here, you're content to be here, you're at peace being here. Wanting is always wanting something more, to be somewhere else, to get more. And if you're happy to be here, you don't want anything in the whole world. You can't trick me there, Ananda. Nice try there, nice try.
Same question. If I want to come here, it is also wanting, isn't it? If I want to go to a retreat, it is also wanting.
Yeah.
So how do we differentiate this wanting and that wanting?
Yes, okay. So this is being in the world. You want to come here, you want to go on a retreat, but once you're here, can you give up that wanting for the hour and a half we're here?
Yes.
And see what it's like.
Yeah.
And then all this other stuff, it's always, you know, a lot of the stuff you do, you've got no choice.
Yeah.
It's not that I want to go back to monastery afterwards. if I decided I'm not going to go back, these 2 monks will be in trouble.
And so it is like present moment.
Present moment, there cannot be any wanting.
Yeah.
You're here. You have to have wanting to get somewhere else or get rid of things. Wanting some pleasure you not already have. My goodness. No more. Okay, there's questions on here then. Suppose we stop indulging in the senses. Indulging? And then something good comes to us by itself. Can we enjoy it then? You've got no choice. Or should we still refuse to indulging it? Refusing is wanting. Wanting to get rid of things. When something good comes to us by itself, it's here. Wanting it, not wanting it, it's here. So don't disturb it. Please clarify how we can deepen our practice with this understanding of lessening craving, wanting. Those sense restraint guarding the sense. Through sense restraint, guarding the senses to reduce our craving for the senses, then the mind slowly decreases. Yeah, that sense restraint is important. A lot of times, do you do sense restraint? Or does it just happen? You know, this is a weird thing about the teachings of the Buddha, but I remember that somebody who brought breakfast to us on Tuesday, that I gave her a piece of paper. It was from the Anguttara Nikaya, the Tens, Sutta number 2, I remember it now. And it's where the Buddha had this beautiful sutta, enlightenment is a natural process. You don't have to make will or choose, oh may the next part of the path happen. It happens automatically. The powerful teaching of the Buddha. So check it out if you wish. Anguttara Nikaya, the Tens, Sutta number 2.
Chetanatharani.
Yeah. Excellent. Did you have a look at it? It's powerful. You don't do anything. You vanish. And it happens all by itself. That's just like Ajahn Chah saying, you sit down, open up, it's perfectly still, don't move, open out your hand, a mango will fall. Right into your hand. It's so counterintuitive at first. But then again, this is actually how it works. I'm not being a Zen monk, I'm just being a disciple of the Buddha. Question 4, we are assuming that reincarnation is true. No, we're not assuming it, we know it's true. It's not a belief, it's a knowledge. In the same way, a knowledge that Surbiton Monastery exists. I can say that's not an assumption, that's the truth. It's the same way you know that reincarnation exists. If reincarnation isn't true, and we only have one lifetime, wouldn't it then make sense to indulge in sense pleasures? It would. But the thing is, it's not true. There is such a thing as rebirth. Otherwise, if you can get away with it, then people try that, to try and get away with it, and just they enjoy themselves, and then they police are at the door, and you shoot yourself. Think, okay, I had a good time, I can't get any more good fun, so you shoot yourself, but you find out it doesn't work. You get reborn again. That's what the Buddha said. Rebirth is true. This is the word of the Buddha class. It's not the word of Ajahn Brahm. It's not the word of, I don't know, Eckhart Tolle. It's the word of the Buddha class. The Buddha certainly, clearly taught rebirth. And as far as I'm concerned, it's a truth, not a belief. Any other questions there? Yeah, go on.
Arjun, why we usually say like desire from five senses you need to take off rather than not saying six senses mind, why we don't include this thing? Because when we want something, isn't it the mind?
Ah, it's maybe the mind has a part in it, but when we want something rather than the mental states, independent mental states, then that's a different ball game. But it's still wanting to have some sort of existence or get rid of things. The other two wantings, Bhava Dhanha and Vibhava Dhanha, get involved. But most of the time, people are just concerned with wanting something to do with the five senses.
So like when people reach to like nimitta, that's free, is that free from, totally from the five senses still, or still there are some
maybe still wanting? Just, no, the five senses may still be around there somewhere. But if it's a really strong nimitta, the five senses become distant from you. In fact, they've mostly just disappeared.
Thank you.
I hope you're enjoying this and we're not going too deep and too far for you.
Oh, Ajahn Brahm, regarding this one thing, you know,
yeah,
and self-restraint, okay? The one thing leading to suffering. Yeah, the Buddha says he's teaching about suffering and ending of suffering. You know, don't you think for a general practitioner, you know, we should experience the natural, you know, your instinct, you know, how, you know, the one experience it, this thing, okay, and get the suffering. You understand? Experience the suffering.
Yeah,
that's where you learn through the experience, isn't it? Instead of just restraining or that.
I think you're correct there. Oh. If you really want to understand what cancer is, mm, please get cancer first of all. Mm. Otherwise, you don't know what you're talking about. Mm. Of course, you can't say that. Mm. Do you know what COVID is like? Mm. Well, how can you know without getting COVID? So please take all your masks off, mm, and let's everybody share COVID together. And then once we know what it is, then we'd be much more wise. Mm. But of course, because that doesn't make any sense. I'm being sarcastic. In other words, you don't need to follow that intuition when it has not been conditioned, you know, by that wisdom of being a stream winner, at least. So if you can put your hand up and say, yes, I'm a stream winner, and then maybe that intuition you can follow. Otherwise, it may lead you into all sorts of places which you'd rather not be. Mm. All sorts of problems. Mm. It's great intuition, but I'm just going for broke this evening, this afternoon. In other words, just not lessening the Buddha's teachings. I've noticed that as being a monk, sometimes it's, you know, what the Buddha says here, what you know, and sometimes you downplay it. You say, well, yeah, you know, you've got a point there. Even though I don't really believe it, so I don't upset you. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to do that today. Mm. Is that okay? Mm. I hope so. Anyway, that's what I've said. Okay. Anything else? Oh, do we have another question here? No. Yeah, just one question. Okay. Yes?
So until the Four Noble Truths is fully understood, we need to walk in the path. How important it is, saddha or the confidence, because until we realize it, we are not fully there, especially in Buddha or the Noble Teachers.
Yes, the confidence is important, and that confidence grows with experience. And it's sometimes my job as a teacher to actually to teach us honestly, non-discriminatory, and not teaching down to you. It's very easy to teach down here, only lay people. You don't need to do jhanas and stuff. Later on in life, maybe. I rebelled against that a long time ago. I will teach you as I would teach any other person who comes into this room, as a monk or a nun or anybody. Teach what the Buddha taught as best I possibly can. And if it's a bit too much for you, then maybe you can come to the Friday night talks instead of the Sunday afternoon ones. Then you've been to the retreats we teach in Jhana Grove. That's another place where I don't hold back. And I was surprised. Okay, let's teach Dharma totally, purely. And don't say, well, you know, reincarnation might be, might not be. It is. If you don't want to accept that, fine. You don't need to come. And there's enough people going to Jhana Grove, as you know, every retreat. Within about 5 seconds, it all fills up. So, that's what I'm teaching. Some people will like it and give some fame. Some people will hate it and get sort of the blame, the criticism. Welcome to life. Okay. Okay, it's almost time to finish off now. So now I'll just close off the computer, close off the questions, and we bow 3 times to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. And if you have personal questions, please come up afterwards.